Yes. Hello, and welcome to the podcast where we look at theology, tradition, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and we throw it all away. We ask, what do I believe? Why? And what does the Bible say? Anyway, and we build reconstructed faith. Yes, hello, and welcome back to Reconstructed Faith, where we consider what we have always believed, whether it's traditional, theological, or otherwise, whether it is of our own construct or it has been handed down by pastors and teachers and parents. We ask, do I really believe this? Why? And we see what the Bible has to say. We've been learning to read the Bible on its own terms instead of ours, which is no small task, I might add, to put your mind in the framework of the Bible instead of putting the Bible in the framework of your mind. Most of us prescribe to one brand of theology or another, and we tend to let that be the lens through which we read the scriptures. And I'm trying to do away with all of that and let the Bible say what it says and form my theology based simply on the text and not a pre-existing construct. And you guys are along for the ride to reconstruct your own faith. So just to recap, for those who may be listening to this for the first time and didn't catch what is the Bible, the problem of sin, or the reality of hell, we're going to recap that we've learned the wages of sin is literally death. Entropy entered the world because of sin. Death, disease, COVID-19, if you will, only exist because creation itself was corrupted by sin. The entropy of our bodies finally ends with us running out of energy, ceasing to function, and dying. Whether that is from disease or so-called natural causes, it's all because of sin. When our body dies, our soul moves into a lobby area. We found out that the Jews at least believe in this, a heavenly waiting room, Sheol, as it were, where all dead go. It's similar to the Greek idea of Hades. So whatever you want to call it, Sheol, Hades, heaven's waiting room, whatever. We wait there until the day of judgment. Where Yahweh, that is Father God, the Lord, what have you, will take those who are his into his kingdom. Okay? But if God's standard is perfection, and we are all guilty of breaking God's law in one way or another, whether it be lust or hate or laziness or whatever, then how do we enter God's kingdom? Well, today, we're going to look at the power of blood and the crucifixion and why the cross of Christ was not only necessary, but is indeed the only way in, as he claimed. So let's get started. The idea of sacrifice is nearly as old as sin itself. In Genesis 3, verse 21, it tells us that Yahweh God made for Adam and his wife garments of skin, and he clothed them. Now, is it possible that God just poofed into existence clothes? Sure it is, he's God. But that would be contrary to how we had seen God work up to that point. He did, we see that God made man from the earth. He took dirt and formed man from the clay. We see that the earth was formless and void and existing before God gave it its particular shapes and made the seas and the continents and all the stuff. So he takes what is and he perfects it, or he takes it from what it was and makes it what it can be. So, with that framework, we believe that God killed an animal and used its skin to make clothes for Adam and Eve. This was the first death, by the way. God killing an animal to cover their nakedness. The animal died to cover their sin. And this is in the very beginning of the story. This is Genesis chapter 3, all the way at the beginning of the Bible. So the animal died to cover their sin even before God had established his covenant and laid out the rules for sacrifice. Let's move on to Genesis chapter 4. This passage is interesting because it's controversial. So Cain, who tended the land, brought an offering from the fruit of the ground, and Abel, who was a shepherd, it says, brought an offering from the choicest of his firstborn and their fat portion. God favored Abel and accepted his sacrifice and did not favor Cain. We know the rest of the story. Cain got jealous and killed his brother. Anyway, what we can't seem to agree on is why God rejected Cain's sacrifice. There's two sides to the argument. Those of us who are more fundamental or covenantal in our thinking, it's obvious to us that Cain's offering was rejected because he did not offer blood. And then there are those that look at the passage and say, well, obviously, Cain wasn't repentant, considering his jealousy and soon-to-be homicide, and that he just brought fruit. He didn't even bring his choicest crops, just whatever he felt like, and God rejected it because it wasn't his best. I actually think that both are true, so here's how that works together. Cain was unrepentant. He didn't love God and didn't follow his commands, so his heart was the issue. But also, if he had loved God and did follow his commands, he would have gone to his brother and picked out a sacrifice to offer God the blood that was required to cover sin. So, we can see again that it is only death and blood that can pay for sin, because the wages of sin is death. This is a theme we see over and over and over again in Genesis as we follow the narrative. After the flood in Genesis 8, we see Noah build an altar and sacrifice one of every clean animal and every clean bird. God smelled the aroma and then promised never again to flood the earth. Then there is the story of Abraham and Isaac on Mount Moriah, where Abraham was to sacrifice Isaac. But because of his obedience to the Lord, Isaac was spared and God provided a ram. Now, let's fast forward a bit and zoom way in. Okay, and look at the Passover in Exodus. And then the rules for the commemorative Passover festival. We'll look at God's rules for sin offerings, and we will look at the scapegoat. We're going to look at God's heart and how he truly feels about sacrifice in the Psalms and prophets, and then we will make a case for the cross of Christ, why he had to die, and really how the cross pays for sin in the grand scheme of things. As I've said before, I'm not trying to complicate the gospel, okay? The gospel is a simple, beautiful thing. But sometimes, especially in this day and age where we are sucked into so-called critical thought and are obsessed with logic and reason, there's air quotes there in case you can't gather that, it's important to be able to show how it all works together. That's what we do here at Reconstructed Faith. We learn theology with an apologetic intent, so that we can logically explain in a critical fashion how salvation works for those who can't accept a simple gospel. I don't understand why there's this false dichotomy between the gospel and intellectualism. Why is no one questioning what they believe? Not out of doubt or skepticism, but out of deeper understanding. I think it is vitally important that Christians not only know what they believe, but why, so that when hard questions do come along, rather than shaking their faith, they have the wisdom to navigate new information. Paul tells us in Romans 12 that it is a renewing of the mind that transforms us into those that have the wisdom to see God's will. And Peter tells us in 2 Peter to grow in knowledge. God speaks to our heart. I will never deny that it is our hearts that are sinful and our hearts that need saving. It is our hearts that ultimately believe the gospel. After all, we are to confess with our mouth and believe in our hearts that Jesus is Lord. However, if your mind is not actively engaged in your faith, then your mind can and will be swayed. So, with that in mind, I want you to have an answer if someone asks you why Jesus needed to die. How it makes sense that God sacrificed himself to himself, because let's be honest, the world is full of skeptics, and your average Christian is bad at dealing with this kind of opposition. That is why I'm here doing this podcast, doing this series on the gospel, because if we can't even defend the foundational doctrines like the gospel, that's a problem. So let's look at Exodus chapter 12. This is from the ESV, the English Standard Version, as per usual. Okay, so we know the story with the 10 plagues, let my people go, all that stuff, finally ending in the plague of death, where God kills all the firstborn. The details are important, though. We really need to zoom in here and look at this. The sacrifice was a male lamb or goat, 1 year old, so that meant it was fully grown but still a virgin. It was pure. We also see that it needed to be without blemish. The NET Bible, that's the New English translation, says a perfect lamb. And then we see that it had to never have broken bones as well. They take the blood, smear it on their doorposts and over the door, and the destroyer of Yahweh will skip over the houses with the lamb blood. So the blood of a spotless lamb saved the Israelites from death, ultimately leading to the end of their captivity and their freedom to follow the Lord. The Lord established the Passover as a yearly remembrance of this event, where a lamb was sacrificed every single year. We learn in Leviticus 23 the details of the Passover week and its accompanying feast. So, we can see here how the blood of a spotless lamb saved the Israelites from death, and death is the wages of sin. So let's, you know, we'll just keep that train of logic going as we continue on through the information here. In the desert, God creates the Law of Moses and a very detailed outline for blood sacrifice. Some were to just be a sprinkling of blood on the sides of the altar. Some were to be burned, including the fat. And others still, like for the Day of Atonement, were to actually sprinkle blood on the mercy seat of the ark. Now, for those of you that don't know, God had the Israelites build the tabernacle. It was a tent with a fence around it. Inside the fence, between the fence and the tent of meeting, was an altar. Inside the tent were candles, a table of showbread, and a few other things, and a curtain. This curtain hid the Holy of Holies, where the Ark of God was kept. If someone entered the Holy of Holies without first being cleansed, they would die in the presence of God. And anyone other than Aaron, the chief priest, would die, even if they were cleansed. Only the high priest was allowed in God's presence, because God lived on the ark. The lid of the ark was known as the mercy seat, okay? And the very presence of God was seated there on the lid between the wings of two cherubim that ordained the top. You've seen it. You know, you definitely know what the ark of God looks like, even if you don't think you do. It's been in movies. It's been in TV shows. You've seen it. So, let's look at Leviticus chapter 4 through 5:11. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel, saying, if anyone sins unintentionally in any of the Lord's commandments about things not to be done, and does any of them, if it is the anointed priest who sins, thus bringing guilt on the people, then he shall offer for the sin that he has committed a bull from the herd without blemish, to the Lord for a sin offering. He shall bring the bull to the entrance of the tent of meeting before the Lord and lay his hands on the head of the bull and kill the bull before the Lord. And the anointed priest shall take some of the blood of the bull and bring it into the tent of meeting. And the priest shall dip his finger in the blood and sprinkle part of the blood seven times before the Lord in front of the veil of the sanctuary. And the priest shall put some of the blood on the horns of the altar of fragrant incense before the Lord, that is in the tent of meeting, and all the rest of the blood of the bull he shall pour out at the base of the altar of burnt offering, that is at the entrance of the tent of meeting. And all the fat of the bull of the sin offering he shall remove from it, the fat that covers the entrails and all the fat that is on the entrails. And the two kidneys with the fat that is on them at the loins and the long lobe of the liver that he shall remove with the kidneys." It is super detailed as far as this sort of stuff. Now, verse 13. If the whole congregation of Israel sins unintentionally, and the thing is hidden from the eyes of the assembly, and they do any one of the things that by the Lord's commandments ought not to be done, and they realize their guilt when the sin which they have committed becomes known, the assembly shall offer a bull from the herd for a sin offering and bring it in front of the tent of meeting. And the elders of the congregation lay their hands on the head. Blah, blah, blah. They bring blood of the bull into the tent of meeting. The priest dips his finger in and sprinkles it seven times before the Lord in front of the veil. So same as before. They take all the fat from the outside and on the innards, including the kidneys and the liver and all that. And the priest shall make atonement for them, and they shall be forgiven. He shall carry the bull outside and burn it up. Okay, so we see this here. When they made a sin offering, it made atonement for them, and they were forgiven. So, through the blood, they were forgiven. So, verse 22, when a leader sins, doing unintentionally, we see all this, basically, it's just a repeat. We list a bunch of different ways people can sin, different types of sin. And again, we take a bull without blemish, or a lamb, depending on the type of sin. You see, verse 22, when a leader sins, you bring a male goat without blemish, lay the hands on the head, kill it, burn the fat, all that, sprinkle the blood. When people sins unintentionally in doing any of the things that the commandments say ought not be done and realize their guilt, let's see, they take a female goat without blemish. So we see that if it's a priest or, Israel as a whole, it's a bull. When a leader sins, it's a male goat. If a common person sins, it's a female, goat. Let's see. And the priest shall make atonement for him, and he shall be forgiven. If he brings a lamb as his offering for a sin, he shall bring a female without blemish. Blah, blah, blah. Hands on the head, sprinkle the blood seven times, remove the fat. And the priest shall make atonement for him for the sin which he has committed, and he shall be forgiven. So what we see here is whether it was a bull or a goat or a lamb or doves, whatever it is, every time we see, it was to be without blemish, spotless. It was to have no marks. We can see this in Numbers 29, I think it's verse 8, says to offer up 7 male lambs without blemish. There was to be blood on the altar, blood sprinkled before the tent of meeting, which was where the ark resided. Blood poured out, fat portions burned, just lots and lots of blood to cover lots and lots of sin. All of these statutes were to be followed to the letter depending on your particular sin. And whether you were a commoner or a leader or a priest or whatever, it was slightly different. But we can see at the end of each section that the blood atoned for the sin and they were forgiven. So blood, death, is the price of sin. Okay, so let's go ahead and move ahead to chapter 16, where we learn the 10th day of the 7th month every year was to be the Day of Atonement. This is an interesting passage. We could get really sidetracked here and get into the nature of the Elohim and the Divine Council and the Watchers and all of that, because it does talk about releasing a goat into the desert for Azazel, and we could get onto that whole rabbit trail, but we're not going to do that today. So I'm still studying that topic. That's an entirely different discussion we may have at some point, although I'm just starting to look at it, so it will be a while. But back on the power of blood, one other side note here, actually. We see the origin of the term scapegoat in this passage. One goat was to be sacrificed to the Lord, and the other had all of the sins of Israel placed on it, and it was sent in to the desert. Okay, so here we see Aaron has to enter into the tent of meeting and bring blood before the mercy seat and sprinkle it on the mercy seat 7 times. 7 is the number that represents completeness, but I will save biblical numerology for another lesson. We see him do this with the blood of a bull to atone for his sins so that he can then be clean in order to represent the sins of the people. He then brings the blood of a goat and sprinkles its blood on the mercy seat. If you look at verse 16, this was done to atone for all their sins. He then had to do the same thing to the altar outside the tent of meeting and cleanse the altar from the sins of the people, again, with the blood of a bull and a goat 7 times. We're starting to see just how serious sin is, in case you didn't get that point when we talked about sin. But even with all of this sacrifice and all this blood and the scapegoat taking all their sin away, it only lasted a year. God required this Day of Atonement every single year to purify and cleanse his people. If we continue on with the narrative, however, we begin to see that this really just became a motion for Israel to go through without any kind of repentance or change in their relational mindset, or rather lack of relational mindset. David realizes this after his sin with Bathsheba. In Psalm 51, David wrote in what we call verse 16 and 17, "For you will not delight in sacrifice, or I would give it. You will not be pleased with the burnt offering. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken contrite heart. O God, you will not despise." But that's, you know, that's kind of a side point, but I did want to say that all of this ritual sacrifice eventually just became going through the motions, and there was no heart change. The Israelites continued to sin over and over and over and over again, much like us in our lives, which is, you know, I'm thankful we're not on a system of blood sacrifice. I'd be spilling a lot of blood. Okay, So we've looked at Passover and the requirements of a lamb with no blemish or broken bones to be killed, so blood could be used to mark them safe from death. We have looked at sin offerings and the repeated requirements, whether a bull or a goat or a dove, to be without blemish. It's definitely a theme. We also looked at the Day of Atonement and the idea of a scapegoat that took all their sins. If we aren't lying to ourselves, we can start to see the outline here for Christ. But let's go ahead and take a look at Jesus, his sinlessness, that is, his being without blemish, a spotless lamb, in quotes, so to speak. And also, we will look at the crucifixion specifically and see how, even though it was common to break the legs of those being crucified, we can see that Jesus' legs were not broken. I'm here to make the case to you so that you may understand if you don't, and also so that you can understand more clearly, even if you do, how to present and defend the purpose of the crucifixion to those who question. I make the case that Jesus was God's Passover lamb, that his blood, just like the blood of the lambs in Exodus, will mark us safe from death on the day of God's judgment. If we understand sin, the need for atonement, and accept Jesus' blood on our behalf, we can escape the second death, that is hell, even though we deserve nothing less. Let's first line up the crucifixion with Passover. This is the number one requirement that Christ is the Passover lamb, that he actually died on Passover. So let's look at Matthew 26 and Luke 22. Matthew 26, 1, when Jesus had finished all these sayings, he said to his disciples, "You know that after 2 days the Passover is coming, and the Son of Man will be delivered up to be crucified." Well, I think we're done here, but just to be thorough, let's keep going. Let's look at Leviticus 23 real quick to look at the particulars of Passover. The days of unleavened bread and the Passover feast, verse 4. By the way, all verses are in ESV unless I say otherwise. So if you want to follow along, you can. I'm going to try and work more Bible into these podcasts so it's not just me talking about the Bible and stuff. I'm actually kind of convicted about that a little bit. I want to show my work, so to speak. So if you want to look at Leviticus 23:5, "In the first month, on the 14th day of the month, a twilight is the Lord's Passover. And on the 15th day of the same month is the feast of unleavened bread to the Lord. For 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall have a holy convocation," which is a holy assembly. I actually had to look that up when I was writing this because I didn't know what that word was. It happens now and then. "You shall not do any ordinary work, but you shall present a food offering to the Lord for 7 days. On the 7th day is a holy convocation. You shall not do any ordinary work." Okay, so let's go back to Matthew 26. Let's start at verse 17. "Now, on the first day of unleavened bread," that should look familiar. We just looked at that. "The disciples came to Jesus, saying, 'Where will you have us prepare for you to eat the Passover?'" Now, let's look at the next chapter, and that's going to be Matthew 27. Let's look at verse 15. "Now, at the feast, the governor," this is Pilate, just for context, "was accustomed to release for the crowd any one prisoner whom the crowd wanted." Which feast, I wonder? Well, if we look at the context of the previous chapter, we can see that it was the Passover feast of unleavened bread. Okay, more proof. Now, let's take a look at Luke just for kicks. Luke 22. "Now, the feast of unleavened bread drew near," which is called Passover. You can see here that Luke uses more detail because he was writing to a non-Jewish audience, whereas Matthew, who was writing to Jews, he therefore had no need to explain the details of Passover or what the Feast of Unleavened Bread was. So, verse 7. Then came the day of unleavened bread on which the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed. This was more detail for Theophilus. Okay, I think we have more than proved that it was indeed Passover the week of the crucifixion. In fact, it was that very day, if you continue to read in Luke, that Jesus was crucified. So, now we need to prove that he meets the requirements of a Passover lamb. He needs to be spotless, without blemish, and not have broken bones. So, let's address the elephant in the room. The missing 18 years of Christ's life. Also, that just because the Bible doesn't talk about his sin doesn't mean he didn't sin, right? I mean, that's the argument at least. Well, when we look at the biblical narrative as a whole, the Bible actually goes out of its way to speak to the flaws of the heroes of faith. Abraham lied about Sarah, his wife, when they were in Egypt, and had God not protected her, she would have been raped by Pharaoh. Abraham failed to love or protect his wife sufficiently. We see Isaac commit the same sin as his father, and Jacob, the one whom the name Israel comes from, was a liar and a thief who dishonored his brother and his family by stealing not only Esau's birthright, but his blessing. Moses was a murderer, David an adulterer and a murderer. This was the man after God's heart, by the way. The biblical authors go out of their way to show the humanity of these characters. In the New Testament as well, we can see Peter deny Christ. We see him cut a guy's ear off. James and John were known as the sons of thunder. They asked if they could call down fire. We see the very human nature of the early leaders of the church in the book of Acts when Paul has to get after and correct Peter for ways that he was acting. John Mark, the man who wrote down Peter's gospel account and was present with Paul on his first journey, was the naked man in the garden. Okay, so we've got public nudity now covering the Bible. I can go on and on and on about the character flaws of biblical characters. So, if Jesus had committed sin, it would be shown. Just as the human failings of every other biblical character get brought to light by the text. Also, James, not James of the 12 brother of John, but James, the author of the book of James, who was Jesus' brother, in case you don't know that. James is singular in the New Testament in speaking of the importance of the law. Adherence to the law of Moses will bring justification, he says in the book of James, even going as far as to claim that faith without works is dead. A man who writes over and over again about the law and the principles held within it was obviously a very devout Jew, elevating the spirit of the law far above that of his contemporaries. He knew and lived with Jesus longer than anyone else as his brother. He would have been present even in the 18-year gap. If Jesus had failed to keep the law, would a man like James, brother or not, really follow him? I don't think so. This man was in love with the law. So, if we can make the case that Jesus never sinned, and because his father was God, he didn't inherit original sin, then he is the only human ever who has kept the law and made it to heaven on his own. Jesus didn't need a scapegoat. He didn't need blood to cover him. He was, in the eyes of the Lord, spotless, without blemish, blameless, and pure. Now, let's look at John 19, verse 31. since it was the day of preparation, and so that the bodies would not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for the Sabbath was a high day, the Jews asked Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away. Okay, so the Jews were asking the Romans to make them die faster so that they could be taken down and buried before the Sabbath started at nightfall. The reason they would break legs is because it would keep the crucifiees, if that's a word, those being crucified, from being able to lift themselves up to take a breath. It quickened their suffocation. So, verse 32, the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first and of the other who had been crucified with him. But when they came to Jesus and saw that he was already dead, they did not break his legs. Okay? So, that's a lot of stuff. We've moved over a lot of information pretty quickly. So let's process all of this and put it in order. We've learned previously that the wages of sin is death, yes? And we saw that on the day of Passover, those that had blood on their doorposts were safe from death. Safe from death by the blood of a lamb. We learned that every year, this Passover was to be commemorated by the blood sacrifice of a spotless, unbroken lamb. We see the importance of blood sacrifice in various rituals designed to cleanse the sin of Israel and make them holy before the Lord. Yes? Okay. Jesus was perfect. He was without sin. Blameless before the Lord, crucified on Passover at or near the time when the Passover lamb would have been slaughtered. God offered himself, okay, through the person of his son, Jesus Christ, as the final, eternal Passover lamb to save us from the wages of sin, that is death. He died the death that you and I deserve for our sin, even though he had done nothing wrong. And then rose again. But that's a subject for next time. Thank you for listening to Reconstructed Faith, where we examine what we believe and question everything in order to understand it better. I hope that this has stretched your mind, touched your heart, and blessed your soul, and you are one step closer to reconstructed faith.